Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 28th of December. This is Morning Ireland on RTE Radio 1. I'm Gavin Jennings. Today, roll up and roll out. Taoiseach de Leo Varadkar on final vaccine plans and a COVID surge. Also from Shan Nose to Zoom Nose, a new life for an old style. And cancel culture, how Galway's big year fell to COVID.
And in sport, Ulster get the better of Connacht in Pro 14, while Liverpool and Tottenham are held to draws in the Premier League.
We're with you till nine. The news is read by Kieran Evrin.
The Cabinet will meet later today to discuss the post-Brexit trade deal agreed between the EU and the UK on Christmas Eve. The meeting was originally scheduled for tomorrow but has been brought forward by 24 hours. Supports for those sectors most affected by Brexit are expected to be discussed at the meeting. Separately, the European Parliament leaders are expected to decide today on a timetable for ratifying the deal. The UK Parliament will meet on Wednesday to vote on the agreement. British citizens are being urged to take out comprehensive travel insurance and check their mobile phone roaming policies when travelling to EU countries after the end of the Brexit transition period on Thursday. The UK Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove has also told businesses that there would be some disruption and procedural changes that everyone needed to prepare for. Ireland's rollout of coronavirus vaccinations will start tomorrow, a day earlier than planned. The head of the HSE, Paul Reid, confirmed that a small number of people at Beaumont and St James's Hospital in Dublin and Cork and Galway University hospitals would be the first to receive the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. The chief medical officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, has warned there's been an acceleration in the growth of the virus and there are higher levels of COVID-19 in the country than current figures suggest. He was speaking last night after the Department of Health confirmed 744 new coronavirus cases. The 14-day incidence rate per 100,000 of the population now stands at 209.6. US President Donald Trump has finally signed into law a $2.3 trillion coronavirus aid and spending package agreed by Congress. It restores unemployment benefits to millions of Americans and averts a government shutdown tomorrow. Mr. Trump initially refused to endorse the spending package, saying that the $600 coronavirus support payment should be increased to $2,000. The lawyer for a Chinese citizen journalist who reported on the early stages of the coronavirus pandemic in Wuhan says his client has been sentenced to 4 years in jail. Jian Jian was charged with picking quarrels and provoking trouble, a criminal offence often used in China to punish dissidents. The trial took place just weeks before an international team of World Health Organization experts is expected to arrive in China to investigate the origins of COVID-19. Russian officials say 17 people are feared dead after a fishing trawler sank in the Barents Sea. Rescue vessels were searching for survivors, but emergencies ministry said just two crew members had been rescued out of a 19-member crew. Authorities believe an ice accumulation on the trawler had led to its sinking. At least 4,500 homes and businesses were without power overnight as winds associated with Storm Bella swept across the country. Atlantic coastal areas were worst affected, particularly parts of counties Cork, Kerry, Galway and Mayo. ESB Networks expects to have power restored to most premises this morning or by early afternoon. A Met Éireann yellow wind warning for Atlantic coastal counties remains valid until 2 o'clock this afternoon. Winds will reach mean speeds of up to 65 kilometres per hour, with gusts of up to 110 kilometres per hour in Donegal, Galway, Mayo, Sligo, Clare, Cork and Kerry. In Northern Ireland, a snow ice warning is in effect until 10 o'clock this morning. And now the weather forecast.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Ulster Bank. Thinking of switching your mortgage? The Ulster Bank mortgage team are available to talk. Hail, rain or shine.
Blustery today with widespread showers of rain or hail. Some may turn wintry, especially on higher ground. And there's a risk of spot flooding where bands of showers develop. However, there'll be intermittent brighter spells also. Highest temperatures of 4 to 7 degrees, but feeling very cold in fresh to strong and gusty northwesterly winds. There's a warning that northerly winds will reach gale force or strong gale force today and tonight on Irish coastal waters from Roaches Point to Slinehead to Fairhead. North to northwest winds will reach gale force at times today from Howth Head to Carnsore Point to Roaches Point and on the Irish Sea south of Anglesey.
RTE Radio 1 Traffic and Travel with the Hyundai Ioniq Electric. Winner of What Car's Electric Car Award for Best Family Car in 2020.
The latest travel news from the AA. There are a number of trees down in Kerry this morning. One on the N86 between Camp and Dingle. One on the Tralee to Ballybunion Road at Ballyduff. And two on the N17 Ring of Kerry. One is between Kenmare and Blackwater and the other is on the Carsaveen side of Glen Bay. It's very quiet traffic-wise this morning, but if you must take public transport today, Lewis, Bus Éireann and Go Ahead are all running to a Sunday set schedule. Saturday timetables are in place for most Dublin bus routes, with Irish Rail running altered services and some Sunday schedules too. Finally, frost is lingering around Roscommon town, with very wet conditions reported across much of the country, so do take care if you have to make a journey this morning. Aisling Bonner, AA Roadwatch.
Thanks, Aisling. 6 minutes past eight, here with It Says in the Papers, is John S. Doyle.
The COVID-19 vaccine is the big news for most papers. The Irish Daily Mirror reports that the first injections will be given as early as tomorrow. The Irish Examiner and Irish Daily Mail say the vaccine will be given tomorrow, a day earlier than originally planned. The Irish Times agrees that the vaccine programme will begin tomorrow. The Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, is reported as saying that the state will vaccinate up to 20,000 people a week from early January. The paper notes that a particular focus is coming to bear on the issue of consent in the design of the immunisation programme. The Irish Independent says it understands that finalising the informed consent process was one of the reasons that vaccination did not start immediately. The paper reports that the first 10,000 doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine arrived in Ireland on Saturday, but the first patients won't receive them until tomorrow. Tomorrow, the Mail says, will be an historic day in the fight against a global pandemic and the beginning of the road back to a normal life. Meanwhile, RTE has opened the door for Sean O'Rourke's return to the airwaves. So the Irish Sun reports, based on remarks made to the paper by the station's Director General, D. Forbes. Sean of the Undead is the headline. The Irish News leads with the newly declassified Irish state papers from 1990. John Manley reports that Danny Morrison, former publicity director of Sinn Féin, has poured scorn on a Department of Foreign Affairs communique of the time, which suggested that the IRA Army Council was against Sinn Féin representatives leading any negotiations with Britain. However, the Irish News columnist and historian Brian Feeney said that the internal government correspondence from May 1990 was an authentic reflection of the twin processes pursued at the time, one with the IRA, the other involving the Sinn Féin leader, Gerry Adams. There is much coverage in the Times and Independent of other aspects of those released state papers. The Times reports that Gerry Adams privately warned John Hume that he was worried that the IRA were close to murdering Margaret Thatcher, after they had assassinated one of her close friends, the Conservative MP Ian Gough. That's from a memo stamped secret from a diplomat, Dermot Gallagher, to the then Taoiseach Charles Haughey about a telephone conversation with John Hume in September 1990. The Independent reports that far-sighted Irish diplomats anticipated Brexit-like fissures in the Conservative Party and British society some 26 years before the UK voted to leave the European Union. Back in the present, the Times reports senior political and industry figures warning that despite the Brexit deal agreed on Christmas Eve, key sectors of the Irish economy will face disruption. The Examiner comments in an editorial, "It is not idle speculation to imagine that Brexit will accelerate another vote on Scottish independence that might just pass." Scotland could hold the key to Northern Ireland's future. That's the view of Jane Morris, Deputy Speaker of the Northern Assembly, writing in The Times. She promotes the idea, proposed by an Irish academic after the Brexit vote, that an alliance between the Republic, Northern Ireland and Scotland within the EU, a new Celtic association, could solve the Brexit problem.
Morning Ireland, it's 12 minutes past 8 and it's Monday. The Taoiseach and Minister for Trade, Enterprise and Employment, Leo Varadkar, is here. Good morning.
Morning, Gavin.
The first vaccines against COVID-19 infection will be given here tomorrow. Does this represent the beginning of the end of the pandemic here?
I believe it does. Vaccines in themselves won't eliminate COVID-19. It'll probably be with us forever in some form or another, but it will allow us to get on top of this virus and make it a normal virus, if you like the many other viruses that we deal with all the time. So vaccines start tomorrow in some acute hospital settings in Cork and Galway and Dublin with some healthcare staff and long stay patients. And then it'll be extended over the course of the next few months. Initially, it'll be slow. The supply of the vaccine is limited. We'll have about 40,000 doses a week coming in throughout January. That'll allow us to vaccinate maybe 3% of the population, a bit more in the first month of the year. But as other vaccines come online, like the Moderna vaccine, expect that around the 6th or 7th of January, maybe the AstraZeneca vaccine later in January. That one doesn't require very cold temperatures for storage, so we could see things ramp up then very quickly throughout February and March, setting up mass vaccination centres and so on, using GPs, surgeries, pharmacies, and then things will speed up a lot.
Why weren't we ready to start vaccinating the day the first vaccines arrived? I mean, other countries were ready. Why weren't we?
Yeah, you know, they arrived on the 26th of December, and we'll start vaccinating on the 29th of December. So, you know, it was a 3-day delay, if you like. Some countries, Holland, I think, isn't going to start until the 8th of January.
Yes, but others did start straight away.
They did. Now, understanding there were some things that had to be sorted out, you know, obviously training and education for the vaccinators. Consent forms are quite important too, patient information leaflets. One thing in Ireland that we'll be very careful about is the whole issue of informed consent, making sure that people understand what the vaccine is, what side effects are, for example, and the case of elderly patients or those with dementia, making sure that we talk to their next of kin. So
yes,
you know, we have procedures in Ireland that are probably at a different standard than may exist in other countries.
Yes, because I mean, those same challenges would have existed in other countries who want to prioritise elderly and vulnerable people first too. I mean, are there delays with arranging agreements on consent of care home residents? Is that why they're not going to be vaccinated until January the 4th to start with?
And no, my understanding there was that the medical experts in NIAC, the National Immunisation Advisory Committee, wanted the vaccines to start in acute hospital setting so that we'd be able to build confidence, so that the vaccinators, let's say something went wrong. There are a few cases in England where people had an anaphylactic reaction, which does happen, of course, as you know, with vaccines. But the thinking was it'd be better to start off in an acute hospital setting with the full backup of medical teams there in the very unlikely event that something went wrong, and then moving on to the nursing homes within days.
Is there a concern or a fear of litigation?
Always when it comes to medicine and healthcare, you have to bear that in mind. It's particularly the case in Ireland. You'll be familiar with litigation that occurred around the Pandemrix vaccine for swine flu.
Yes.
10 or 12 years ago. So, you know, I think anything we do in Ireland, whether it's around any kind of medical care, whether it's immunizations or screening or maternity care, we are at a heightened concern around litigation. But that in itself isn't necessarily a bad thing. It does make sure that we take a little bit more time to make sure that we get everything exactly right. And bear in mind, this vaccine is starting tomorrow, you know, 29th of December. The first people start to receive this vaccine in 3 weeks' time. The first people will have had their second dose and will have immunity to the virus. And we'll see over the course of the next few months, large numbers of people being vaccinated. That will reduce the mortality rate, which is so important. That's why we're targeting those who need the vaccine most first, healthcare workers and those in long-term residential settings, and then moving on to the wider population. And when we start vaccinating young people in large numbers, I think we'll then see case numbers fall too.
The last time that we were on air here on Morning Ireland on Christmas Eve, we were talking to Professor Philip Nolan, who looks at modelling and epidemiology for the National Public Health Emergency Team. He was telling us that the restrictions that are in place now and that are planned for next week won't be enough to bring the virus under control, to bring the R rate under one. Do you agree with them?
I don't know yet. I think we will see. You know, we know that level three max back in October, November did bring the R rate under one and brought cases down, and level five last time did as well. So one of the concerns we have here, of course, is that this new variant of the virus, which is part of the mix now, might change those calculations. But honestly, we won't know for sure until really the first week or even the second week in January, because when restrictions are brought in, you know, there's a good 10 to 14 days before that shows up in the figures. So the restrictions only came in starting on the 24th of December. So yes, realistically, it'll be the first week in January or second week before we know.
But you've had new advice from NPHET since then. The Cabinet is meeting today. Will you consider further restrictions?
We'll certainly discuss COVID. Obviously, the reason for the Cabinet meeting today is Brexit, and it's there to agree the UK-EU trade and cooperation agreement. I'm sure we'll have a discussion on the COVID situation, yes, as well. But like I say, the restrictions, the level five restrictions agreed by Cabinet only came into effect on the 24th of December, and really are only coming into effect over the next couple of days. So we know and we understand that that won't be reflected in a fall in case numbers until the first or second week in January. And what the CMO suggests today is absolutely correct. A very small number of people attended for tests around Christmas Day, Stevens's Day. That has shown an artificially low number yesterday of around 700 and so new cases. We would expect to see cases no matter what is done. No matter what is done, we will see cases rise until the early new year, and then we would hope to see them fall off.
But given the way they're rising, I mean, what about household visits, for example? The guidance is that they can continue for four more days. Is that advisable in your view?
It's reduced to one, as you know, from today, I think it is.
Yes.
Or yesterday, rather, sorry. And then there won't be any household visits at all from New Year's Eve. So, you know, we know from past experience that restricting household visits works. It was one of the most effective measures back in October, November. But people, you know, we do appreciate that it is the Christmas period, that people do want an opportunity to meet up with family and friends. It doesn't mean you have to do it, by the way. The fact that it is allowed doesn't mean that you have to. We are saying to people to minimise the risk. It's better to meet outdoors than indoors. If you are meeting indoors, reduce the amount of time that you meet up. Try and stay apart. Wash your hands. Don't share utensils. All of those things that can make a visit much safer.
Well, you can consider closing non-essential shops, given that they're now closed in the north since yesterday or the day before.
But one thing we know from the modelling, and you mentioned Professor Nolan there, one thing we know from the modelling is that opening non-essential retail in early December and in the previous periods in the pandemic didn't have a major effect on the numbers. So, you know, that's something we have to bear in mind, that if we're going to take an action.
Our understanding is that NPHET may well have recommended that too. We haven't seen, of course, sight of this recommendation to Cabinet in their last recommendation.
Well, they recommended, obviously the recommendations change a lot over the days, but they recommended the full level five. So that would be the 5 kilometre limit and closing non-essential retail. But they also, if you followed their press conference last week, made the point that the easings of restrictions that occurred on the 1st of December, which is getting rid of the 5 kilometre rule, getting rid of or opening non-essential retail, only made a small difference in the numbers. So one thing we have to bear in mind as a Cabinet is that if you do something that we know is only going to make a small difference, is it worth all the other consequences? And we have to bear in mind that any restrictions that we put in place now could be in place for quite some time.
If case numbers continue to rise at their current rate, by the time that schools reopen or are due to reopen, the prevalence will be higher than at any time during the pandemic. Would you reconsider opening schools if there is so much of the virus in the community?
No, the plan is to open schools as intended across the 4th, 5th and 6th of January. And
yes, but will you reconsider that plan?
We've no plans to reconsider it.
Should you?
I don't believe so, you know, unless we receive advice that we should, you know, from from the scientists or the medical experts. But, you know, the advice that we have at present and the experience that we have at present is that opening schools work successfully, that these are relatively safe environments. Children in their pods are safe.
With case numbers the way they were when schools were open, but if, for example, we're heading towards 2,500-3,000 cases a day by January the 6th, and that is perfectly feasible looking at the numbers that we're facing at the moment, would you not reconsider opening schools? If a prevalence is that high, I know you make the point about the safety of schools so far, but that was against the backdrop of a different prevalence of the virus.
Well, bear in mind that, you know, the incidence of the virus now, the 14-day incidence of the virus now is around 200.
Yes, and rising.
It was 300, yes. And the schools were open, and while there were clusters and outbreaks, they were manageable. So, you know, we had schools open at a much higher incidence than we have now. But like I say, you know, none of the scientists or medical experts are saying to us that they think that we need to reconsider reopening schools. So,
how long will the current restrictions last, and what's the target for when you can ease them?
Well, the government has said that we would review the restrictions again on the 12th of January, and we will. But, you know, as I said to you earlier...
You don't realistically envisage relaxing them by then, though, do you?
I don't. You know, and I can't speak for the entire government on this, and things can change, of course, between now and the 12th of January. This virus can change very rapidly. But given that the restrictions are only coming in now, I don't think we would start to see numbers fall until the first or second week in January. Therefore, they would not have fallen enough by the 12th of January. And I also think the availability of the vaccine does change things now. You know, we can actually now foresee the point at which we'll have vaccinated those most at risk, very elderly people in long-term residential care and healthcare workers. And I think there is a case for saying that restrictions that are in place, you know, should stay in place until that's done. But that also needs to then be reflected in the kind of restrictions that we put in place, because they need to be sustainable for a prolonged period. They're not just for 3 or 4 weeks.
Do you have a target? I mean, how many people would need to be vaccinated before you could ease restrictions?
We haven't set a target, but, you know, the target around easing restrictions, you know, is always falling case numbers, hospitals not under undue pressure, and the R number below one. But as you know, and everyone listening knows, the minute you are, not the minute, but once you ease restrictions, within a few weeks, numbers start rising again. And I think with the vaccine now being available, there would be a case of saying to the Irish people, you know, perhaps we should keep these restrictions in place until such a time as we have protected our healthcare workers, our most vulnerable. But again, that speaks to a separate issue, that if restrictions are going to be in place for a prolonged period, not a few weeks, but maybe a few months, they need to be ones that are sustainable.
A Brexit deal agreed on, a trade deal agreed on Christmas Eve. What disruption are you expecting over the next few days?
We think there will be some disruption in the ports, obviously our own ports, but also Holyhead and Dover. But this time of year is not a very busy time of year in terms of freight. So we think we'll be able to manage it. Obviously, businesses need to be prepared. The UK is leaving the single market and the customs union on the 1st of January, so need to be prepared for red tape, for customs declarations that have to be filled in, and also for checks. And this is always the case when these things are being done for the first time, even though there have been dry runs, we do think there will be some disruption. But just think how different it could have been. You know, 4.5 years ago, when the UK voted to leave the European Union, we were worried about a hard border between North and South. We were concerned that our businesses, our farmers, our agri-food sector could face tariffs on trade with Britain. And through a lot of political work and diplomatic work over the past 4.5 years, we've protected Ireland from that. And this is, you know, this is a much softer Brexit than the one that we feared 4.5 years ago. And I think that's a positive thing.
There are going to be people who are going to be affected. There are going to be people who are probably going to lose their jobs as a result. What are you going to be able to do to help them?
It is going to depend on the various different sectors. So, for example, one of the things that we'll be approving at Cabinet today is a €100 million scheme to help the food sector to adapt. And that'll be launched by Minister McConnell Logan and I later in the day. And that's going to be run through Enterprise Ireland. There is the Brexit Adjustment Reserve Fund, about €5 billion available from that, from the European Union. Some of that will be used, for example, to help our fishery sector, which will be impacted by the changes that have been agreed. But again, bear in mind, the thing that we were most concerned about economically, the thing we were most concerned about politically, of course, was the hard border, the common travel area and citizens' rights. that's all been protected. The thing that we were worried about most economically was our businesses, our exporters, having to pay tariffs on goods exported to the UK, or quotas limiting the amount they could export. That has all been avoided through the through this new agreement, which Cabinet will ratify today. And that means the impact on business is going to be very different. It's going to be much more around bureaucracy and costs and additional delays. But we'll still have access to that British market, which is so important, particularly for our farmers, our beef sector, our food industry. And that has been protected. So in terms of the impact on the economy, we estimate what we'll see over the course of the next 10 years is the economy growing by 2% less than it would. Or by 2 or 3% less than it would, but not causing a recession.
Leo Varadkar, thank you. It's 26 you. Minutes past 8. Now, concerts, lectures, football training and even Christmas parties went online this year. Eleanor Mannion met with the champion Shan Nose dancer from Connemara, who found a new way to teach people from around the world the traditional Irish dance.
From Shan Nose dancing in Connemara to Zoom Nose dancing around the world.
So Zoom Nose is a phrase that one of my students came up with. I think Zoom is definitely becoming everyone's best friend. For me, it's the new parish hall where I go and do my dance classes.
In a year when everything went online, champion dancer Emma O'Sullivan tapped into a global love for the traditional Irish dance with her Zoom Nose classes.
Now I have students all the way from Japan right around the world to California. There's a real mix there, but they all have the same thing in common. They all love Ireland, they all love Connemara, and they all know about Shan Nose dancing, which is amazing.
Teaching Shan Nose classes around the world means long days for Emma. Her day begins at 7 a.m. with classes to Japan and finishes with a 10 p.m. class to Brazil.
I love waking up, putting on the computer and just seeing all those happy faces tuning in from Japan. And they're always so like energised, upbeat, so happy to be there. And just gives you a great lift to your day. It's a lovely way to wake up. I'm happy to teach the dancing and pass on, you know, the history and the heritage. But on my side, they're giving me so much entertainment as well, because I'm still in lockdown too.
Madoka Hori is one of Emma's Japanese students.
It's very wonderful thing that we can learn from the teacher we want directly from Ireland. We can learn steps by watching YouTube or maybe other performances, but it's very important to learn how the histories are or the backgrounds of the steps. That's very rare opportunity.
New Yorker Marjorie Stewart hopes the classes will help her to surprise a few people.
My fantasy is, just because I've been going to a lot of sessions before, Irish sessions before the coronavirus set in, and I just really hope that by the time it's time to go back to real life and I go to these sessions, and I know a lot of the musicians that are playing in the sessions that I go to, but I would love for them to just be playing and for me to just jump out and start doing it, like really, really well.
In a year when so many traditions were put on hold, Emma believes she's tapped into something special.
The reason why this Zoom Nose, Shan Nose is so ideal for COVID, for all the lockdowns, all the restrictions, is it's a dance that you can do yourself. So you can social distance all you want. You don't need a partner. Shan Nose dancing is on the spot. We don't use up the floor space that would be in the other dance styles. So for a lot of people, all they need is one small corner of the house to do their class. They're providing me with all the entertainment that I suppose I would have had going to live venues and doing the concerts and being out and about. They're filling that time for me too. So it's magic on both sides, I think.
And that was Shan Nose dancer Emma O'Sullivan finishing that report from Eleanor Mannion. It's 8:30. You're listening to Morning Ireland. Kieran Evrin has the latest news.
Thank you, Gavin. Good morning. The Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has said the rollout of the COVID-19 vaccine, which begins tomorrow in acute hospital settings in Cork, Galway and Dublin, will be slow at first, but will be extended over the course of the next few months. On this programme, he said the supply of the vaccine is limited, with about 40,000 doses a week of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine coming in throughout January, allowing 3% of the population to be inoculated.
As other vaccines come online, like the Moderna vaccine, expect that around the 6th or 7th of January, maybe the AstraZeneca vaccine later in January. That one doesn't require very cold temperatures for storage, so we could see things ramp up then very quickly throughout February and March, setting up mass vaccination centres and so on, using GPs, surgeries, pharmacies, and then things will speed up a lot.
The Cabinet will meet later today to discuss the post-Brexit trade deal agreed between the EU and the UK on Christmas Eve. The meeting was originally scheduled for tomorrow but has been brought forward by 24 hours. Supports for those sectors most affected by Brexit are expected to be discussed at the meeting. The European Parliament leaders are expected to decide today on a timetable for ratifying the deal. The UK Parliament will meet on Wednesday to vote on the agreement. At least 4,500 homes and businesses were without power overnight as winds associated with Storm Bella swept across the country. Atlantic coastal areas were worst affected, particularly parts of counties Cork, Kerry, Galway and Mayo. ESB Networks expects to have power restored to most premises this morning or by early afternoon. And the weather forecast. Blustery today with widespread showers of rain or hail. Some may turn wintry, especially on higher ground. And there's a risk of spot flooding where bands of showers develop. However, there'll be intermittent brighter spells also. Highest temperatures of 4 to 7 degrees.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Full EV or plug-in hybrid? Go electric with Kia. For more, log on to kia.com.
And Darren Frell's here with the sports news. Morning, Darren.
Very good morning to you as well, Gavin. Well, last night Ulster beat Connacht 32-19 to make it 9 wins from 9 in the Guinness Pro 14 this season. And that win extends their lead at the top of Conference A to 7 points, although Leinster do have 2 games in hand. It's their first win at the sports ground in 5 seasons. Very disappointing loss, though, for Connacht, who were on top in the first half. They were 12 points now behind Munster in that Conference B table. And their coach, Andy Friend, was pretty disappointed when he spoke to Michael Corcoran. Certainly a game of two halves.
Yeah, not pleasing at all, Michael. I thought the first 40 minutes, I thought we were the dominant team there. Probably didn't get some of the rewards I felt were due our way. But we went into the sheds half-time feeling pretty comfortable, confident. But we didn't turn up in the second half. It's an 80-minute game of football, and I take nothing away from Ulster. I thought they were fantastic in the second half and just squeezed us.
Was there a bit of a change in the weather conditions at halftime? It looked as if the wind had a stronger part to play in that second half.
Yeah, it definitely picked up. It's when we won the toss and we decided to run that way. And hindsight's a wonderful thing. If we'd known, we might have changed. But, I'm not going to blame the conditions nor anything else. Ulster turned up in the second half and played better football.
And you've got to get out of that sort of cul-de-sac that you're in at the moment, like Bristol last time and here tonight now as well.
Yeah, there's a theme happening there where we're in the game and then we're not in the game. So, yeah, that's something we definitely need to look at. And I know we've got a good group of coaches, a good group of players, and we can build our way out of that. But we've got to make sure we have an honest look at ourselves too, because there's something happening there that's not right at the minute.
Yeah, 2 more big games in that Pro 14 among the Irish provinces next weekend. Shamrock Rovers playmaker Jack Byrne looks like he's on the brink of a move to Apoel Nicosia in Cyprus. Now, Byrne has travelled to Cyprus to hold talks with the side now managed by Mick McCarthy. Liverpool remain top of the Premier League despite being held to a 1-1 draw by West Brom. Tottenham are just outside the top four after Wolves came from behind to secure a 1-1 draw. Leeds beat Burnley 1-0. West Ham and Brighton played out a 2-2 draw. But let's get some reaction from the Liverpool result. Jurgen Klopp, their manager, admitted it was a very frustrating night against West Brom.
West Brom deserved the point tonight because we didn't finish the game. We didn't have enough clear-cut chances. It is difficult to create. Well, it's a busy period, all that stuff, a lot of games we played, all that's all an explanation. But in the end, I think everybody knows and feels like we should have and could have done better tonight, and then we would have won the game, so it's a draw. It's not a game we will talk about in 20 years, but it's a game we had to play, and we didn't play it as good as we could.
Now, more horse racing at Leopardstown this afternoon with day three of the Christmas Festival and another great card as well. The Savills Chase is the big one, but the Christmas Hurdle is also a race that will attract plenty of interest. 12:05 start at Leopardstown, but you can watch live coverage on RTE2 and the RTE Player from 1 o'clock. There's also racing today at Limerick from 11:55. Finally, the defending darts champion Peter Wright has been beaten in the third round of the World Championship. He lost to Gabriel Clemens in the last 32. Sports updates throughout the day on the RTE Sport website and also the RTE News app. Back to you, Gavin.
Thanks, Darren. 8:37. Cultural events were hit hard by the pandemic, with COVID-19 regulations closing venues and reducing access to the arts in the usual locations. Galway was to have been on fete all this year for the European Capital of Culture, but after a tortuous lead-up, the programme had to be largely abandoned due to the impact of coronavirus. Our Western correspondent Pat McGrath has been looking at the Galway 2020 project and hearing from some people in the city about what kind of legacy it will leave behind.
The city of Galway.
July 2016, and after a lengthy bid process, Galway is named as the 2020 European Capital of Culture.
The feeling was extremely high. There was total and absolute jubilation. If you think about the 2 years prior to that, the entire artistic and cultural community, but also the general public, had become totally invested in the bid. They had a tremendous amount of ownership of the bid book, the contents, the initiative behind it, and it was an incredible coming together of all of that pride of place and passion and delight and sense of possibility.
Maria Moynihan-Lee of event organisers Milestone Inventive, recalling the mood in the city before and after the designation was awarded. In a place synonymous with culture and the arts, there was a sense back then that Galway was on the cusp of its biggest showcase.
Well, that was a very optimistic time, Pat. You know, we were celebrations on Shop Street and all of that, and everybody was delighted and felt that it was going to be a great year, 2020. Unfortunately, that was not the way it turned out.
The Galway bid book, Making Waves, pledged an ambitious programme of events that would engage with people across the city and county throughout 2020. For people like Galway International Arts Festival CEO John Crumlish, there was a huge sense of anticipation.
It just means so much for so many organisations. Cultural, business, tourism, everything will benefit hugely, and I think the great work that's been put in the last 18 months will carry on. We've got a network and a community that are just so focused and working together and making this a great 2020. We'll be one of the smallest places ever to host it, and I think we'll be one of the best.
But in the months that followed those celebrations, concerns began to emerge, a sense that what had been promised would prove more difficult to deliver. Arts organisations were worried about funding, planning issues and communication. The company set up to oversee the year, Galway 2020, played down the teething problems, saying they were common to projects of this nature. Speaking in summer 2018, CEO Hannah Kiley said things were on track.
I'm delighted with the progress. I think we've done a really good job in the year to date. These couple of weeks we're putting our heads down to make sure we can come out in October with the full roadmap of where we're going, but I'm happy with where we are. We're very much on track where I wanted to be when I took up this position a year ago.
Maria Moynihan-Lee says many problems at this stage of the process stem from the approach taken by Europe to the Capital of Culture initiative.
There is a fundamental flaw in the model of capitals of culture and the way in which they're delivered all over Europe. This has nothing to do with Galway, not just Ireland, but the same things keep going wrong in this everywhere it goes. People start to become slightly more and more and more and increasingly more disempowered as the structures begin to get set up, as the key appointments are made. That's where it all starts to unravel.
And that's exactly what happened in Galway.
The arts community finds itself being rejected as less than, not good enough, in favour of external expertise, which, hand on heart, you can't honestly say is superior. Yes, it's very, very, very important to bring in external influences, to have cross-border transnational cooperation in developing projects, but that's not actually what really happened. It was very much more blunt than that. It was a sense that the expertise, the knowledge, the experience, which we all know exists here, maybe isn't good enough and is almost unconsciously rejected.
By late 2018, there had been cancellations of some planned events and ongoing funding difficulties cast doubt on the ability to meet an initial €45 million costing. Then board chair Aideen McGinley acknowledged the problems but appealed to the public to get behind the event.
What I'm asking is that the people of Galway can, as they have before, come behind us. The negativity that we're facing is very draining on everybody in the organisation, and we need the positivity to be able to help us now roll out this programme.
In the months that followed, there was a renewed focus on getting Galway 2020 over the line. A new CEO, a new board chair and a new creative director were appointed in quick succession as the clock ticked inexorably towards a new decade.
We have resolved some issues. There's more issues to resolve. But the culture producers and ourselves will work collaboratively to address those issues.
By September 2019, the finishing touches had been put to an impressive programme, which was launched in front of thousands of people in Eyre Square.
Out of tonight, I think we will start to build up that enthusiasm again. I've no doubt that the people of Galway will be four square behind it.
And so this time last year, Galway 2020 was good to go. There were some lingering doubts and some vocal naysayers, but above all, there was a sense of hope around the city that the delegation would have huge benefits over the year and into the future.
So T-1 is always a very exciting place to be, and yeah, we have to get it right. The opening event, I think, sets the tone for the rest of the year.
The formal launch was set for early February.
Obviously, if you do an opening ceremony in Ireland in February, you're not going to be blessed with kind of Caribbean weather. So we've made it about the wind and the water and the weather, and it's down on South Park, right next to the Atlantic. And I guess the biggest risk that I always run when I run an event outdoors is, you know, the thing I really can't control is the weather.
The project's creative director, Helen Marriage, speaking the week before an elaborate €2 million opening ceremony was to take place in South Park on the shores of Galway Bay. Her weather-related concerns proved to be well-founded.
Good afternoon from the newsroom. The opening ceremony for Galway 2020, which was due to be held in the city this evening, has been cancelled due to expected bad weather. Up to 45,000 people were due to attend the event.
And so instead of a bells and whistles launch in front of thousands, a couple of hundred people gathered in a Galway hotel for the official start of the project. Weeks later, all bets were off.
You know, there was a moment where you had to sort of say, is it to be or not to be? And there's no doubt that the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune were flung at us at an incredible rate.
Arthur Lappin is the chair of the Galway 2020 board.
It was a great tragedy. We lost our opening, and it was only a mere month after that that COVID started to impact. I think in responding the way we did, I think there was a huge amount actually salvaged. Probably the biggest loss to us was the international dimension of the festival, because international travel was extremely difficult for artists and the whole quarantining thing.
If there was no pandemic, I firmly believe that the cultural partners would have delivered to the absolute max, because by then the challenges that I mentioned earlier, that are all to do with the model and the issues with how it's handed over to be delivered by any city anywhere in Europe, all of those things had been largely ironed out.
Despite the huge logistical difficulties posed by public health restrictions, Galway 2020 has managed to deliver a number of projects this year. An eye-catching installation by artist John Gerard on the banks of the Corrib, the Druid Gregory tour across the city and county, as well as several limited exhibitions and shows. And the designation has been extended until the end of April, giving some hope that more can be salvaged in early 2021. Arthur Lappin says €25 million provided to the project in state funding has been correctly allocated throughout the process.
I'm not going to lie, it's not what we had planned this time last year. I think we have done extremely well. I'm very proud of the fact that the money that we had originally to spend, had intended to spend on art and artists during this year, has been spent on art and artists. And, you know, lest anybody, and I know that we've had our detractors over the years, but, you know, I can tell you this, I've rarely, if ever, come across an organisation that is that has the thoroughness of governance that this has had. And I assure you, when the accounts are eventually published for the entirety of the event, there will be nothing wanting in terms of how we have exercised our responsibilities in relation to that. But most importantly, that the money has been spent not on administration and on management, it has been spent on art and culture.
With the dust settling, attention is now on the legacy of the project.
The value isn't there because we didn't get the project. We didn't get the year we hoped for. The City of Culture idea is a very physical, people on the streets kind of idea, totally impossible in 2020.
Vinnie Brown is manager of Charlie Byrne's Bookshop and the long-running host of Galway Bay FM's Arts Show.
It's very difficult to see how 2020 can have a legacy when it didn't really happen. I mean, it was very disappointing for them and very disappointing for us as well. You know, what I thought was going to happen, Pat, was that it would be like the Volvo Ocean Race of 2009, where people complained about it and complained about it, and then when it happened, everybody said, this is the best thing ever. That was what I was hoping for. But unfortunately, that wasn't how it happened.
After all the twists and turns, Arthur Lappin contends the beneficial footprints from the Capital of Culture will endure.
The very process of actually applying and implementing Galway 2020 has that very action or those actions have created very significant legacy. For example, the experience that a lot of people that wouldn't have had this experience before have had working on the project, the sense, the palpable sense of Galway internationally as a direct result of Galway 2020 is still out there. Those seeds are still there, ready to be reaped. Anybody who's run a European City of Culture will tell you that the cycle of legacy, for example, is a 10-year cycle, that it takes at least 10 years to be able to measure the impact of a European Capital of Culture.
And a positive note to end from Maria Moynihan-Lee. She says that while it may take time, the city's cultural life will be enhanced by the journey the arts community has been on.
The legacy is going to be in the form of an arts and cultural community which has gelled and become a force in and of itself and will be a force for very positive outcomes for many, many years to come, working together as they never had before, because that's what happened to them during their whole Capital of Culture journey. And that, I cannot see that fading in any way. That's a wonderfully positive thing to come out of it, and not something that everybody will appreciate until they start to see the results. It'll be 5 or 10 years before we can point to, oh, well, those two organisations first worked together during 2020. It's going to be a lot less tangible than you expect, but it's going to be a huge strengthening of the firmament and the foundation of the arts and cultural sector here in Galway.
That's Maria Moynihan-Lee ending that report on Galway's year as European Capital of Culture from Pat McGrath. Back to our main story this morning. Earlier we heard from the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar. He was talking about the start of the vaccination programme against COVID-19, which begins tomorrow, and that restrictions to try and slow the spread of the disease could last several months until those most at risk of getting sick from the virus are vaccinated. Let's talk now with Dr. Colm Henry. He's Chief Clinical Officer with the HSE and he's in our Cork studio. Dr. Henry, good morning.
Good morning.
Talk us through what's going to happen tomorrow. Who's going to get the vaccine?
Well, in line with the recommendations that were drafted together by NPHET, accepted by government, we are prioritising residents and healthcare workers in long-term residential care settings in recognition of the fact that they are in the most vulnerable setting based on our experience here in Ireland, and they have probably suffered more in terms of the restrictions imposed on the country as a consequence of the COVID-19 pandemic. So we plan to roll out this week the vaccine in 4 hospital settings with some older people. And beginning next week, beginning the 4th of January, we begin that programme in nursing homes, ramping up in line with the expected deliveries of the vaccines in much greater numbers throughout January, into a 6-week rolling programme throughout all nursing homes for those two vaccine jabs that are needed 3 weeks apart in all 582 nursing homes, public and private.
And why aren't nursing home residents not starting to be vaccinated to January the 4th, when we would have had the vaccine from the 26th?
We chose in this country, like many other countries, to prioritise nursing homes, and they present particular complexities in terms of rollout of the vaccine. People aren't, for a vaccine programme to be successful, it's not just a question of speed, it's a question of safety, and in order for a population, including, and in particular perhaps, frail residents of nursing home settings, we have to demonstrate that we are adhering closely to the correct process to respect all those safety protocols we need with respect to any vaccine. And that includes registering each patient who's going to take up this vaccine. It includes making sure there's fully informed consent. It includes identifying the exact number in each of those 582 settings, which we've worked through and shared with Nursing Home Ireland. And it ensures making sure that we have those numbers coming through deliveries every week in line with the expected need for that rolling 6-week cycle.
But other EU countries would have faced the same challenges in terms of elderly patients, in terms of consent and safety, but they were ready. Why is it taking us to January the 4th?
Well, we received the vaccines, 10,000 doses, almost 10,000 doses on December the 26th, and we're using much of that stock this week in those four acute sites. And as I said, in this country, what we need to do, what our process is for every vaccination programme, in order to reassure people who are listening today or anybody in residential care settings that we're adhering closely to all safety protocols, is we have to produce the final guidelines that inform the education.
Dr. Henry, apologies for interrupting. Other countries have to adopt those guidelines as well. These are other EU countries. They're not wildly different in terms of their health systems to us. Why is it taking us longer?
No. We were preparing all those education and training materials in parallel with all the information we knew. The final information we knew that informed a conditional marketing authorisation of the EU came through to us, was interpreted for us by NIAC, and is the substance of an educational programme that it will be for all our vaccination teams tomorrow. So we will. It isn't just a question of speed, Gavin. It's a question of safety, and we want to put safety first and foremost in the rollout of this programme, because in order for most of the population to take this up at the level we need to demonstrate that we're doing this safely.
Part of your safety concern is giving this in hospital settings until January the 4th, when you, as you said, you're going to start in care homes. And one of the reasons suggested for why it's been rolled out in hospitals is because of the risk of anaphylaxis or extreme allergic reaction. How big a concern is that?
I don't think it's a major concern. I think it's a question of confidence more than safety. There have been some reported cases, a couple in the UK and some others in the USA, of anaphylactic reactions. This isn't unusual in any vaccine, and it's one of the reasons that people with a history of anaphylactic reactions, vaccine is contraindicated in such people. We felt, based on the advice from NIAC, and I agree with that advice, that the best in order to instill the greatest degree of confidence for people, particularly in those older people in residential care settings, we would start off with those first small batches in the acute hospital sites where their medical teams on call, and then roll out beyond those to those 582 nursing home settings.
If 1% of the population, if it's going to take 2 months to vaccinate 1% of the population, that being those in care homes, how long is it going to take to offer to the other 99% of the population?
Gavin, what we have now is we've confirmed deliveries, as you've heard earlier from the Taoiseach, of not just the 10,000 that arrived on St Stephen's Day, but the 30,000 to 40,000 ramping up throughout January and February. And in line with the expected and confirmed deliveries of this vaccine, we are according that vaccine and will be distributing those priority groups. As other vaccines come through that approval process of the European Commission, we will expand out to those other groups in priority that are in the priority setting, older people, other people with chronic conditions, other healthcare workers, and so on, the general population, as increased stock becomes confirmed. We can only finalise our plans based on the confirmed deliveries we get through the advanced purchasing agreement with the European Commission.
With current positive cases at over 1,000 a day, yesterday being the exception, of course, and rising, and their contacts rising too, are you able at the moment to trace the virus and control it through track and trace?
We are seeing levels. We're now, certainly it appears, into a third surge, and activity over the Christmas period shows that there's increased demand in testing, without doubt. Some of the referrals through to community testing centres from the out of Irish GP service have been very high, and on the 22nd of January we saw a record new number of lab tests, almost 23,000 tests done in one day. And in terms of the contact tracing, we've seen a big increase from 9,000 per week upwards of 30,000 per week and 5,000 to 6,000 per day since December the 22nd. second. All this shows the virus is very active out there in the community and it's replicating. There are multiple outbreaks, and we see also, of course, the arrival of this new strain from London and the southeast of England, which is now the dominant strain there, which, based on the experts' opinion over there, is more transmissible. So very active vaccine, very active transmission. There is, of course, a limit to what we can do. We have always said that, that our healthcare service, being hospital beds, critical care beds, our public health teams, have limits to their capability.
Yes, and in terms of your limits on contact tracing, for those cases that are positive now, how far back is your contact tracing going? Is it still 48 hours?
Our contact tracing goes back 48 hours. Our public health teams look into the more complex cases, those outbreak settings, be the schools, be the nursing homes, be the hospitals, and look back further and trace those cases back to, if they can, to a common outbreak setting. But let's be clear about this, Gavin. At the level of transmission we're seeing now,
yes,
the level of outbreaks we're seeing now, the principal control measure are the behaviour of the population and the social restrictions. The outbreak management is a secondary control.
Could you reach a stage soon where people will have to do their own contact tracing again?
No, we certainly don't want to. If we're asking people to do anything, it's to adhere to those, to reduce their contacts to the lowest number possible based on the high increase in cases we're seeing over the Christmas period. That's the single most effective action anybody listening today can do.
At the beginning of this pandemic, the primary concern with controlling the spread of the virus, apart from people getting sick, of course, was overwhelming hospitals. Does overwhelming hospitals remain a concern?
We see two stories at the moment. We see a rise, quite a sharp rise in the recent week in the admissions in acute hospitals and those becoming sick with COVID within acute hospitals. Healthcare acquired COVID. The numbers at 8 p.m. last night were 325. The other side of the story we're seeing is a relatively new phenomenon for the Irish healthcare service, certainly in recent years. A large number of empty beds, 1467 as of last night, and a sharp decrease in the trolleys as compared to this time last year. So what has happened, Gavin, that is one of the few unexpected bonuses of this pandemic is we've seen no lab-recorded influenza cases to date this year. We've seen a sharp decrease in other seasonal viruses to the extent that other illnesses, non-COVID illnesses, are not presenting in the volumes we usually would expect around the Christmas period.
So overwhelming is not a concern?
Not at this time, but what I would say is based on that doubling time we're seeing, based on that growth rate we're seeing of COVID of 6-8% per day, if this continues unmitigated and without any change in the sharp up curve that we're seeing, we will certainly see large numbers of cases, which inevitably will translate into hospitalizations, occupancy of intensive care units, and unfortunately death.
Dr. Colm Henry, Chief Clinical Officer with the HSE, thank you for coming into our Cork studio this morning. That's it for Morning Ireland. Thanks for listening. Audrey will be here tomorrow at 8. Our team this morning, Mark McGrath on sound, our broadcast coordinator, Doc Martin, and our editors, Conor Barons and John Burke. Marty Morrissey is up next here on RTE Radio 1.